Well, good evening, everyone. Good to see you. I'll invite you to turn in your Bibles to Isaiah 55, the 55th chapter of the Old Testament book of Isaiah. As we said yesterday, we're going to spend a lot of our time in the Old Testament, but the reason that we're going to do that is to try to help us understand our purpose as Christians. The first century Christians, I believe, were zealous and excited and knew who they were, primarily because they knew about the prophecies that described them. As we studied yesterday, a lot of things in the Old Testament tell us about Jesus, but there's also a lot of passages that tell us about his people. And those are passages that I've not spent enough time in my life thinking about, but when we see those things and we see the beautiful pictures that God painted of what he was going to accomplish with Christians, it can inspire us and it can help us understand why we're here. I want to do something with Isaiah 55 before we get into this text. I'm going to guess something about your Bible. I might be wrong about this, but if you have one of the normal paper Bibles, not just your phone, which is fine. Phones are good. But if you have a Bible that you've taken notes in, I have a feeling that you might have something underlined or highlighted in this chapter. And if you do, it's probably verse 8 and 9. And that might be it. Now, even if that's not the case, those are the verses that everybody knows in Isaiah 55. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. You've heard those before? Most of the time those get quoted, or I might say misquoted or misused, when somebody is confused about God. When something doesn't make sense, a preacher or somebody well-meaning will say, well, you know, God's thoughts aren't our thoughts. His ways are higher than our ways. As if to say we could never possibly understand God. Now, I understand the sentiment of that, but that's not what this means in this passage. In fact, it almost means the exact opposite. What verses 8 and 9 are in Isaiah 55 are actually a sales pitch. God is not saying that his ways and his thoughts are out of reach. There are other passages that talk like that. But in this particular passage, which is an invitation for us, God is trying to convince us to take on his thoughts and his ways that he's perfectly willing to share. In fact, just so you understand that, look at verse 6. Isaiah 55, 6 says, seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is what? Near. God's not far away in this passage. He's within reach. And what God's trying to do is invite people, all people, to come and listen to his thoughts and his ways and trade theirs, because his are so much better. Now, I want to put this invitation of Isaiah 55 in the context of the book of Isaiah. But I will tell you, this is actually a new covenant invitation. Even though it's prophetic, it's the same invitation that would be extended in the New Testament by Jesus and other preachers of the gospel. And it's in a context in Isaiah that actually has to do with Jesus and and his people. Before we get into this, I often try to find different ways to convince people that don't know God to come follow God. I'm an evangelistic kind of guy. I want people to come to the Lord. I'll tell you that I've not found a better place in the Bible to show somebody that doesn't know about the Bible than Isaiah 55. It is one of the most impactful invitations God ever extended for these two reasons. God is going to say in this invitation what he wants to do for humanity and what he wants to do with humanity. And everybody that we know is looking for answers to those two questions. How can I find help in my life? And how is my life going to have meaning? That's really what Isaiah 55 is going to invite them into. You know, the other great thing about Isaiah 55 is it's really close to chapter 53. And you can just show somebody right here that this is talking about Jesus. But I want you to go back with me to chapter 53, and I want to show you an important transition in the book of Isaiah. Look at Isaiah 53 around verse 10. When this prophecy of Jesus suffering, it says, "But the Lord was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief. If he would render himself as a guilt offering, he will see his offspring, he will prolong his days, and the good pleasure of the Lord will prosper in his hand. As a result of the anguish of his soul, he will see it and be satisfied. By his knowledge, the righteous one, my servant, will justify the many, as he will bear their iniquities." Have you ever read verse 10 and kind of wondered how that could be true? How could God the Father be pleased to watch his own son be crushed? I mean, I can't imagine that. If I watched my son die the way Jesus died and God watched him die, how could there be any pleasure at all in the death of your son? Well, look at the verse again. It tells us why. When Jesus was crushed, God was going to be able to see his offspring. You see that? Your version might say seed. The reality is, if Jesus didn't die, he's never going to have children. And until Jesus died, we had no hope. But once Jesus died, then there was going to be the opportunity for us to be the offspring of God. Now, here's the transition that I wanted to show you. Look at verse 11. You see there in verse 11, at the end of that verse where it says, "My servant will justify the many." In the book of Isaiah, God keeps talking about this servant who is coming. And it's always referring to Jesus. 25 times up until this point, he's been saying, "The servant is coming, the servant is coming." But this is the last time in Isaiah it will be singular. You will not read after this verse, "the servant" anymore. After this verse, he's going to start talking about the servants, plural. Every prophecy after this has to do with you and me, or the offspring of God. To show you that, go to the end of chapter 54. At the end of chapter 54, listen to verse 17. "No weapon that is formed against you will prosper, and every tongue that accuses you in judgment you will condemn. This is the heritage of the servants," plural, "of the Lord, and their vindication is from me, declares the Lord." You hear what God was prophesying? Once Jesus had offspring, once there were servants of God in the new covenant, no weapon that was fashioned against us would ever be able to accomplish anything. You know, it used to be in the Old Testament, an army could come against Israel and take them captive. But do you know now that the church is worldwide and global, nobody can do that. There's no located place where the servants of God live. So no weapon that's formed against us will ever prosper. That's a great promise. Now that brings us to chapter 55. What is chapter 55? It's an invitation for you to become a servant of God, or to be offspring of the Messiah. And it's going to sound very familiar as we get into this passage. So let's go ahead and start reading the invitation together and just looking at this great invitation of God. Verse 1, Isaiah 55. "Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And you who have no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without cost. Why do you spend money for what is not bread, and your wages for what does not satisfy? Listen carefully to me and eat what is good, and delight yourself in abundance. Incline your ear and come to me. Listen that you may live." Let's stop there and notice what we heard. Now, look at verse 1 again. Who's being invited by God? He says, "Hey, listen up. All of you who are," what? "Thirsty." Do you know that's the last invitation in the Bible as well. Revelation 22, 17, that's going to be the call to the Spirit and the bride, say, come, all you who are thirsty, come. That's the last thing the Bible's going to say. It's going to quote Isaiah 55. But notice that here's what God is saying. If you're thirsty in this life, if you don't have satisfaction, did you notice even there in verse 1, if you have no money, you're poor, you're looking for something. I can't tell you how many people I've had read this that didn't know the Bible. And I'll just ask him, what do you think's being talked about there? I've literally seen people get tears in their eyes and say something like, I know exactly what that means. I've been looking for satisfaction in my life. I feel like I've never been able to find it. I totally understand this idea of feeling thirsty and poor and down. Now, does it sound too good to be true? Look at verse 1 again. Hey, those of you who have no money, come, buy, and eat. How do you buy something without money? And he doesn't just say, I'm going to give you bread and water. What does verse 1 say that they, or verse 1 say that you can have to eat? Come buy wine and milk. You know who drank wine and milk in the ancient world? Rich people. That's not poor people food. God is offering the best of things to people who have no way to pay for it. And then he asks this great question in verse 2. Look at this question in verse 2. Why are you spending your money for what is not bread? Your wages for what does not satisfy? You're giving your whole life in pursuit of things that are not filling you up. You know, there's a whole book of the Bible about that. The book of Ecclesiastes. That's another book, by the way, that if you want to teach your friends about God, Ecclesiastes is one of the greatest. Because everybody in this world understands trying to pursue joy and happiness and fulfillment, and they keep coming up empty-handed. They think this next relationship or this next job or this next pursuit is going to be the answer. But the Ecclesiastes writer keeps saying, you're never going to find it. You keep spending your money for what is not bread and your wages for what does not satisfy. Come to me. I grew up in the 80s. This might not be your kind of thing, but I liked music. Does anybody remember Huey Lewis? There's a great song that he sang. It was in Back to the Future. Don't take money, don't take fame, don't take no credit card to ride this train. Remember that? That's the power of what? Love. You know, think about that for a minute. That's a great song. You don't have to be rich. You don't have to have money. You don't have to have a credit card. Anybody can fall in love. Do you know God wrote those lyrics first? You don't have to have money to have every single thing that God ever wanted you to have. Just come to him and listen. How often did Jesus talk like this? Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, I will give you rest. If anyone thirsts, come to me on the fountain of living waters. This sermon in Isaiah 55 appears everywhere in the New Testament. But there's something kind of interesting. God says, I want to feed you, but he's not going to feed these people through their mouths. Did you notice he's going to feed them through their ears? In fact, look at these verses again in verse 2. He says, listen carefully to me and eat what is good. Isn't that kind of a funny picture? Here come the words of God and your ear turns into a mouth and you begin to eat those things. Just to be clear that that's what he's inviting you to, look at the next phrase. Incline your ear, verse 3, and come to me. And then one more time for good measure in verse 3. Listen that you may live. Did you know everybody on planet Earth, and this is going to come up again later in the invitation, everybody on planet Earth has been eating God's provision from the land. The rain and the snow come down from heaven, grows crops, and everyone we know, because the rain of God falls on the just and on the unjust, he's given them life through their mouth with physical food. But Isaiah was prophesying that a time was coming where God was going to send from above words we could listen to that would change everything if we would come and listen. Do you remember how often Jesus talked like that when he would preach? I've always wanted to start a sermon like Jesus did. Before he preached the sermon or the parable of the sower, remember that? A sower went out to sow and he spread the seed. Does anybody remember his first words in that sermon? All right, here it is. He said, "Listen!" A sower went out to sow. And then he got done with that little parable and you remember what he said? "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." You know what Jesus was interested in? Listeners. You know what most people don't want to do today? Is listen. So God says, "Come, listen, I'll feed you." Now watch how this invitation continues. Here in verse 3 he says, "Incline your ear and come to me, listen that you may live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you according to the faithful mercies shown to David. Behold, I've made him a witness to the peoples, a leader and commander for the peoples. Behold, you will call a nation you do not know, and a nation which knows you not will run to you because of the Lord your God, even the Holy One of Israel, for he has glorified you." Now, when I was a boy, this particular passage captured my attention. I was always kind of poetic, so when I would read the poetry of the prophets, I could envision what they were saying, and I loved those passages as a boy. But when I was young, I had no idea what those couple verses meant. What did he mean that he'd make a covenant, an everlasting covenant with us like he did with David? And then he says, "Hey, look what I did with David, and then look what I'll do with you." I didn't understand it, so we're going to skip that for now, all right? Now, I'll come back to it at the end of the lesson. Because it really is what God is trying to say. Here's what I want to do with you in your life if you'll listen to me. But let's wait to come back to those verses. Let's continue with the invitation. Look at verse 6. Here's God's invitation in verse 6. "Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near." All right, I have a question for you. People that you know that stay away from God. Do you know anybody like that? They look at the world, it's difficult, life's not been easy for them, lots of bad things go on. And you try to talk to them about maybe coming to God, and their thought about God is anything but that verse. In their minds, God is so far away, he's so out of reach, he's nowhere near their life. There's no possible way they could ever find him. Isn't that right? But what does God say? "I'm not that far." Do you remember anybody preaching like that in the New Testament? Acts chapter 17, Paul ended up in a place called Athens. And in Athens, all kinds of great philosophers spoke over the years at the Areopagus, Mars Hill. And Paul, the Christian, actually got to stand there where great philosophers had stood and address that crowd about their idols. Do you remember that story? He saw all these idols that they had, and there was one idol to the unknown God. So he got up in front of them and he said, "I want to tell you about this God that you worship in ignorance." Here's what he said. "He made every one of us." By the way, is that a timely message for our day? All the talk about race and all the differences of humanity, wouldn't it be refreshing if somebody could just get up and tell the truth and say, "God made every one of us. We're all his children," Paul said. And then he said this, "He's not far away from any one of us. If we would just grope for him in the darkness, we will find him." Now, where did Paul get an idea to preach like that? Isaiah 55. "Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near." And then we get to verse 7. Remember earlier I said, does it sound too good to be true? Here's the catch. You ready? Yeah, it won't cost you any money, but here's what God will expect if you're going to come to him. Listen to verse 7. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return to the Lord, and he will have compassion on him and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. By the way, that verse makes it clear that it's a new covenant invitation. There's forgiveness in that verse. There's pardon in that verse. There's repentance in that verse. But I want you to notice what God is asking people to give up. Two things. Your thoughts and your ways. I'll tell you what. Josh talked about stepping on toes. Do you know those are the two things nobody wants to give up? Do you think if God said, I'll save your soul if you give me enough money. Do you think there'd be people who would figure out a way to pay that debt and get that paid off? Give some installments, you know, low interest rate? In human history, haven't people been willing to bring God like animal sacrifices? In fact, in human history, if people thought that what God wanted was their children, they'd bring their babies and throw them in the fire. But do you know what nobody wants to give up? Their thoughts and their ways. In fact, I'll test you. How many of you are willing to give up your thoughts and your ways? Now, be careful before you answer this. For Andy Cantrell's thoughts and Andy Cantrell's ways. Meaning, whatever I think you should eat, you eat. Whatever team I say you're going to root for, you root for. Whatever way I tell you to go home tonight, that's the way you go home. The reason I know you won't make that trade is because that's what you guys fought about on the way here. Like, hey, where do you want to eat? I want to eat here. No, my place is better. Hey, why are you going that way to the church building? You should go that way. You guys all argue all the time about your thoughts and your ways. You know why? Because you worked all your life to get those. And nobody else's are better than yours. Except for God's. That's why verse 8 is a sales pitch. If God's going to say, give up your thoughts and give up your ways, you got to convince me, God, that what you're going to give me is better. So here we go. Verse 8. My thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. You think about things like you're down here on earth. I see things from up here in heaven. And listen close to what God's saying. He's not saying, you can never think like me. What he's saying in this invitation is, I want to give you all of these heavenly thoughts for free. All you got to do is give up yours. And everything that I think and everything that is my way, I will give to you. Now, who would refuse that? So let me be a skeptic. I mean, hear Isaiah preaching in the old ancient world. Let me think about what he's saying. And let me respond the way that a skeptic might respond. I don't believe it. I don't believe that God up there is ever going to send down his thoughts and his ways and share them with mankind. Didn't all the ancient people think that the gods were out to get man anyway? Remember all the Greek gods? They hated man. You had to like beg them to give you anything at all. You had to hurt yourself for them to even pay attention. God's not going to share things from heaven to help humanity. I don't believe it. I think God anticipated that objection. Look at the next verse. Verse 10. For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return there without watering the earth and making it bear and sprout and furnishing seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so will my word be which goes forth from my mouth. It will not return to me empty without accomplishing what I desire and without succeeding in the matter for which I sent it. Do you notice what God's doing there? He's saying, look, I'm promising you that I'm going to send my word from up here in heaven. It's going to come down and you can listen to it and it'll change your life. And if you doubt, that I'm going to send you help from heaven. Just pay attention to the physical world. How has God always been feeding us? Rain and snow come down from heaven. And it does two things. Did you catch it? It furnishes seed to the sower and bread to the eater. Or in other words, if it stops raining, we don't have anything to eat. And if it stops snowing, we don't have anything to do. How long would it take for humanity if God just shut up the skies? I don't know how you guys feel about rain and snow here in Illinois. We have mixed opinions in Minnesota. It's snowing this week, by the way. I got an alert on my phone. There's snow accumulation tonight and tomorrow. There's a bunch of people up there that are going to hate it. They're going to hate that that stuff's falling. But did you know there's other people up there that love it? They pray for it. They're called farmers. Because they know that that's God's way of taking care of us. Did you know God's word is just like that? God's word can fall on people, and just like in Minnesota, the snow may lay there for months, and the word of God may fall into some people's lives, and all it does is annoy them and frustrate them until the springtime comes. And finally, what once was annoying to them brings life. I love spring in Minnesota. I've never seen anything like it. Like, the place explodes. Right now, you go up there, you can like put your hand on a tree, and it literally is vibrating, getting ready to come to life. Listen to God's illustration. Isaiah says, someday my word's going to come down. And guess what it's going to do? Yeah, sometimes rain and snow can be somebody's destruction, but sometimes rain and snow can be somebody's health. My word is a two-edged sword. It could cut somebody for judgment, or it could prick somebody's heart and save them. My word will do exactly what I want it to do, God says in this promise. But now is the promise of verse 12. Look at verse 12. For you will be led out with joy. You will go out with joy, and you will be led forth with peace. The mountains and the hills will break forth into shouts of joy before you. All the trees of the field will clap their hands. Instead of the thorn bush, the cypress will come up. Instead of the nettle, the myrtle will come up. And it will be a memorial to the Lord for an everlasting sign which will not be cut off. Now, as we finish this invitation, I want you to remember how it started. Who was being invited? The thirsty, the poor, the dissatisfied in life. Do you know what they've always been looking for? Look at verse 12 again. Two things: peace and joy. Do you know anybody on this planet that's not looking for those two things? Everything they do is trying to find peace and joy. Did you hear what God said? If you come to me and you listen, you incline your ear, if you listen that you may live, if you trade your thoughts and your ways for my thoughts and my ways, I will change the landscape of your life. And then verse 12 turns into a Disney movie. Did you catch that? I mean, it's like Fantasia or something. The trees are clapping their hands. The mountains are breaking forth into shouts of joy. What used to be in verse 13, a desert of thorn bushes and tumbleweeds, there's like cypress trees coming up. What's that about? Now, I know some preachers say something like this. You come to God and you listen to God and everything's going to turn out great. All of your life's going to be great. I need to tell you, though, that what this really is about is that God will change your perspective. Everything will look different. In fact, let's use his illustration. He said, my thoughts are in heaven, your thoughts are on earth. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my thoughts higher than your thoughts. So let's use the first illustration of mountains shouting for joy before you. What does that mean? Have you ever walked up to a mountain? I don't see very many around here. Are there mountains in Illinois? There's none in Minnesota really either, but I grew up in California. There's some pretty good ones there. You ever been to Colorado and tried to hike any of them? But if you walk up to the base of a mountain and you look at it from Earth's perspective, is it shouting for joy before you? Or does it sound like it's saying, "You'll never get over me"? A trial in your life, you come up at it and you look at it from Earth's perspective and it shouts you down. But have you ever gotten in an airplane and flown over the same mountain? Looked at it from up above and you go, "Oh, I can see the other side of that." Help me with this. You guys know this passage in James chapter 1. Consider it all joy, my brothers, when you encounter various trials, mountains. Who in the world thinks like that? Who in the world thinks when they come up to a trial in their life or a mountain in their life, "Oh, this is good news. I'm going to consider it joy. The mountains and the hills, they're shouting for joy before me." Nobody thinks like that, actually. Everyone who's ever come to God and traded their thoughts and their ways for God's thoughts and God's ways, they look at things from heaven's perspective, and now the landscape of their life looks different. I'll challenge you with this. Every converted human being from the beginning of time until the end of history has had an Isaiah 55 experience where they decided they were not going to think their thoughts and their ways, but God's thoughts and God's ways. And because of that, their world looked different and they seemed strange to everybody else. In the New Testament, Paul wrote from a prison, the book of Philippians. What's the theme of the book of Philippians? Do you remember? Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. 17 or so times, Paul's going to say, joy, 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 joy. I'm chained up in a prison. Who talks like that? Who says, my chains have turned out for the furtherance of the gospel? Who talks like that? People who have joy and peace and see the world and don't see all the troubles of life, but heaven's perspective. Now that's New Testament. But since we're going to talk about David again back in verse 3, help me with this. Did David think like this? Was David an Isaiah 55 person who was a man after God's own heart? Didn't think his thoughts and his ways, but God's thoughts and God's ways. So he wrote a psalm, and you guys help me with this psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. When was David's life ever like that? Ever. Still waters? Green grass? Did he write that as a shepherd boy? Even when he was a shepherd, I remember him talking about lions and bears. You know, David was always on the run. David was always leaving his home. David was always under attack. And yet he could say, I have nothing that I want for. God's my shepherd. It's green valleys and still waters. What was the physical reality of David's life in Psalm 23? Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Did you hear what David was saying? Doesn't matter what I go through in this life. Doesn't matter how many times people come against me. It doesn't matter how dark the situation looks. Because God is my shepherd, his thoughts and his ways are my thoughts and my ways now, my world has exploded into life. Help me with the end of Psalm 23. You have prepared a table before me in the what? in the presence of my enemies. Can you picture that? Here come all the enemies of David. And David goes over to the table that God prepared for him, and he sits down. He ignores the enemies and he says, God, I've got a banquet here, and I'm just going to eat this. What's on the table? Maybe wine and milk. All right, since I was talking about the 80s earlier, I'll tell you about another 80s reference. Anybody ever see the movie Hook? It was a Robin Williams movie, and he was Peter Pan. But he didn't know he was Peter Pan. He forgot. He was like a fat old man, you know, and like all the Lost Boys show up and they're like, hey, you're Peter Pan. And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And they take him back to Neverland. And there's this scene in the movie where he sits down at this huge banquet table with all the Lost Boys. And the table is empty. And all the Lost Boys sit down and they're all excited about what they're about to do. And Robin Williams is looking at all of them. And they all start grabbing things and eating. This tastes so good. And remember that scene? And he's just staring at them like they're crazy. And then Robin Williams has an Isaiah 55 moment. Their thoughts and their ways become his thoughts and his ways. And what he sees on the table in front of him is the greatest banquet you've ever seen. And he finds his joy and he finds his peace and he finds his youthfulness. And man, isn't that a great movie? God wrote the script for that in Jesus Christ. What do you think God could do with people like that? I mean, people who are genuinely joyful and peaceful, who the life that they lived, no matter how dark it got, they thought because they saw things the way God saw things, that there was good in the world and good ahead of us. What could people like that do? Go to the end of the chapter again. Look at verse 13. He tells us at the end, it will be a memorial to the Lord for an everlasting sign which will not be cut off. God was going to build for himself monuments that could never be toppled. In the ancient world, if somebody built a monument, an enemy could come through and knock it down and cut it off. But in the new covenant, the monuments would be us. We would make a name for God, your version might say, or we would be for the Lord's renown. You know why people all over planet Earth know who God is? Because there's a bunch of Isaiah 55 people in the world who've traded their thoughts and their ways for God's thoughts and God's ways. And now they are radiantly living their life in a world where people are looking for hope. So go back to verse 3. Let's look at the covenant that God made with David. Incline your ear and come to me. Listen that you may live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you, according to the faithful mercy shown to David. Stop there. Now, in this prophecy, God says, all right, listen, new covenant people, if you'll listen to me, I'll do with you, I'll make a covenant with you like the covenant I made with David, and I showed him mercy. And now we have a natural question. What do you mean? How is my life going to be like David's life, God? All right, next verse. Verse 4, God says, behold, that means look at David. So what does he say about David? Look, I've made him a witness to the people, a leader and commander for the people. You see that? Who was David in the Old Testament? Before God got a hold of him, who was David? He was nobody. In fact, his daddy didn't even bring him in from the field when Samuel came looking for the new king. He was nothing. But God knew there was a man after his own heart somewhere out there in that field. Brought him in. Crowned him king. Made him a witness and a leader, not just of the nation of Israel, David, at the end of his life, in 2 Samuel 22, wrote a psalm. It's also in the Psalms. It's two times in the Bible. I think it's Psalm 18. 2 Samuel 22, Psalm 18, David wrote this long psalm at the end of his life. And do you know what he celebrated at the end of his life? He said, God, I was nothing, I was nobody. If you look around verses 45 and 46 of that 2 Samuel 22. Wherever I go, David said, people come trembling out of their fortresses. They come to me and they look at me like I'm a leader. How did you do that with me, God? Why is God telling us that about David? Look at verse 5. Isaiah 55, 5. Behold, you will call a nation you do not know, and a nation which knows you not will run to you because of the Lord your God, even the Holy One of Israel. Now listen. That's what the early church knew about themselves. That what God was doing with them was bringing people from every nation to himself. Why? Because he had glorified us. We come to him in humility. We trade our thoughts and our ways for his thoughts and his ways. We really genuinely are people of joy and peace. We live lives that are radiant in front of people looking for hope. And nations run to us because we're the light of the world. It's one of the most brilliant passages in all the Bible. And it's about you and me. I'll ask you again. What could God do if his people were really like that? Tomorrow when you go to work and everybody's griping about politics and everybody's talking about how the world's falling apart and everybody's talking about how things at the factory or wherever you work are going downhill and everybody's complaining about everything. What if you were the one who obeyed Philippians chapter 2? Do all things without grumbling or disputing, so that you will prove yourselves to be children of God, holding fast the word of life as luminaries in the sky. What could God do with people like that? I used to preach in Los Angeles, California, before I moved to Minnesota. Right near where the church was JPL. Anybody ever heard of JPL? Jet Propulsion Labs. They worked with NASA. Rocket scientists. Smart people. We didn't have very many of them at church. Till one day this young woman showed up. She had just gotten out of college. Dana Mars is her name. She is now Dana Wade. Dana got a job at JPL. An internship. Rocket scientist. Christian. She come worship with us all the time. And it was during that time that she was there that 9/11 happened. The airplanes flew into the buildings. Everybody's losing their minds. And about a week or two later, Dana came to church and there was this young man with her. And I went up and met him. And he said, my name's Jamin. Jamin Greenbaum. I work at JPL. So much smarter than me. I said, what are you doing here? He said, you know, I've never thought anything about God. But the other day, when 9/11 happened, I was looking around the room at all these people that I admired most, people that knew everything about everything, and they were all losing their minds. He said, but I saw Dana. She wasn't scared. She was appropriately sad about what was going on, but she had hope. And this boy said, I want what she has. He became a Christian. You know why? Because Dana knew how to make every Bible argument for somebody so smart. No. Dana had traded her thoughts and her ways for God's thoughts and God's ways. She wasn't so smart to know that she couldn't look at the world the way God looked at the world. And she had genuine joy and peace. And when somebody said, "What's the reason for the hope that's in you?" She could say, "I'll tell you about the Lord." Folks, let's be Isaiah 55 people every day, everywhere we go, and watch how God not only changes the landscape of our lives, but brings people to himself. Thanks for your attention. After a lesson like that, do I need to offer an invitation? All you who are thirsty, come. If you got no way to pay God off, come. Listen to him. Incline your ear and live. Trade your thoughts and your ways for his thoughts and his ways. And instead of the thorn bushes that your life is right now, the myrtle will come up. And he'll use your life in ways that you never could have imagined. You'll be a memorial for the Lord as an everlasting sign which will not be cut off.